So it feels lovely to have to feel this is the beginning of our Vassa retreat. 3 months ahead of us, have clear space, clear sailing. It's all going to be beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all going to be wonderful. We'll all be enlightened. Yeah, that's how it can feel at the beginning. That's why it feels quite nice at the beginning. And the sense of, I guess for all of us in different ways, and for me at least, I, you know, certainly looking forward to putting down duties, putting down busyness. It'll be a bit of a gradual process for me in the first couple of weeks, but two venerables are already started their solitary retreats. So this space that we create, you know, this is a convention and a space that we actually create for the purpose of cultivating our meditation, cultivating our mindfulness, cultivating the path of the Buddha, actually creating a space, a literal space, you know, putting in certain boundaries. You know, we're not having any guests, we're kind of putting extraneous duties aside, just doing what needs to be done for the most part to keep things ticking over. Assigning roles and duties so as we don't have to engage too much through that time. All of this is about creating a certain kind of space to allow us to really go inwards a bit more than usual, because the usual is not usually bounded in that same way. We're more, the space that we have on a day-to-day basis is a bit more permeable. People coming and going, different things happening. So we create this space on purpose. It's a kind of a convention. You know, Vassa, it's not a real thing in itself, is it? We create it in order to undertake a certain kind of practice and in order to create a beneficial environment for doing that. So it's a really, really special opportunity, a really wonderful opportunity for all of us. I'm not sure any of you are there already, but I have to watch my mind. It's already saying, why can't we have Vassa all year round? It just doesn't work that way. Because we do a lot of work to create the space, actually. Yeah. So once we have the space, we can settle into it. And it takes a little time to wind down, to settle into the rhythm, to get familiar with the rhythm, familiar with the pace, and in a way to become more familiar with ourselves, this body, this mind, what's going on, where we're at. More time to pay attention, more time to be with the body, the mind, as it goes through its more slowed down pace of life over this next few months. So the Buddha highly recommended this kind of mindfulness practice and moving away from busyness where we can to seek seclusion, to have solitude, to cultivate silence internally and externally. All because it aids us in seeing what's happening here. You know, there's a lot of movement in the mind ordinarily, and ordinarily in the world, in our day-to-day life, there's a lot of movement around us. And so this internal movement and external movement, you know, creates a pretty complex dance at times. So the benefits of being able to simplify, just let things become a bit more simple for a while and have a clearer look, have a better look, or a less hassled look at actually what's going on here and now in this body mind. And so we still encounter movement, even as we might have stillness around us, relative stillness around us as we sit in meditation. But the relative stillness really helps support the seeing, really helps support the relaxing, the settling down. So as we begin to see the factors of this very body-mind that are working all the time, working along in their own domains, this thing called me and mine, this body, the functioning of the senses, thinking, perception, memory, desire, aversion, the emotions, the different mind states, the different bodily needs that arise. You know, all of this stuff is happening usually, but we don't get a chance to really be with it in a way that we can observe more clearly, really get familiar with what's going on. We usually, much of the time, we get pushed around by the habitual movement or end up in some kind of struggle with it. So it's not as if that's not going to happen as we move into retreat, but we get to see it a bit more clearly. So this cultivation of awareness, of mindfulness, is the main path factor, the main faculty that we develop to cultivate wisdom, to cultivate clear seeing, to start to just see what's going on here and how it works, not through overly analyzing, because that'll create more movement in the mind, but trusting in the very knowing quality of knowing that is inherently present. There's an intelligence within that. Yeah, just as this analogy that can get overused a little bit, but it's such a good analogy for the mind and meditative cultivation, is that of the lake or a pool of water. When it's stirred up by the wind, you know, ripples move across the surface of the lake and we can't see clearly into the water. We can't see what's reflected, or anyone with good eyesight, the analogy goes, can't see into the water or what's reflected around that body of water because it's just agitated by the wind. And it's just a direct analogy for the mind that is agitated by the various things that stir it up. And sometimes we might say it's the external events that stir it up, the things that are happening out there around us. Sometimes we might say it's the internal events that stir things up, the kind of painful memories or the fearful thoughts or painful sensations, our reactions, etc. And the Buddha says it's actually, it points to the fact that it's the what's called the kilesa that stirs things up. And our not understanding, not knowing these kilesa, keeps things stirred up. So these kilesa in the Pali tradition, it gets translated as defilement. Don't like that word so much, but it's kind of like an impure state, but it's also referred to as something that's adventitious or something that is not innate to the mind. It arises or enters into and impacts. Extending the analogy, one could say the wind is not innate to the lake. The wind comes along and disturbs the surface of the lake, if you like. And this can be known. This can be seen, this can be understood within our own minds, within our own awareness, within our own intelligence, wisdom arises quite naturally through just seeing how things are in nature, in its natural state. So just as we can observe a lake, a body of water, we can observe a lake when the wind is still, we can observe how when the water is calm, the surface of the lake, if there's light, if there's enough light, becomes a perfect surface for reflecting what's around it. And if the lake is still and there's no mud stirred up within it, anyone with good eyesight can also look into the water and see down through a certain depth of the water, see the fish, the weed, the stones, perhaps even to the bottom of the lake. And this is a direct analogy for wisdom. Someone with good eyesight is a natural wisdom that can arise in the mind when there is this clear seeing of just the way things are. Yeah? So the calm, the relative calmness or stillness we can cultivate in meditation, that's what this is, the stillness, the calmness of the lake is referring to. When there's a relative calm, the disturbances subside. And this might feel like a bit like a chicken and egg thing in our meditation, you know. Shouldn't the disturbances subside first and then the lake gets calm? Or do we have to, stop the disturbances, calm the lake before the disturbances can settle down, you know? When we're looking at the mind in terms of calming, it's not an easy thing to make happen. In fact, you can't make it happen. If we try to make this mind calm, it doesn't usually settle down because we're putting in, usually, if we're trying to make it calm, trying to make it be still, through this sense of effort, that quality of effort has a certain energy which stirs the mind. If it's coming out of a sense of wanting to stop those thoughts, stop those kilesa, the defilement, the disturbing emotions, wanting to stop it all, you may be able to force some kind of stillness for a while, but that very energy coming out of desire and aversion has its own input, has its own rippling. So just to be able to have this time to explore in our own hearts and mind, in our own body-mind experience, what is it that helps this mind calm? What is it that helps this mind become calm? What is it that stirs it up? When we witness that, when we observe that, that's the growth of wisdom, where understanding comes through that. Yeah, so that willingness to observe, that willingness to be with exactly what is, in fact, already has a bit of the quality that allows things to calm down. A willingness to be with and observe things as they are. So this is the point of view of the wisdom mind. And as we observe, as we get to know what moves the mind, what allows stillness to come about, how dukkha arises in different situations, all of this is growth for wisdom. Ultimately, it's the wisdom that comes to maturity, that comes to fruition in our mind. Ultimately, it's that wisdom at its maturity that releases the mind from the activity of clinging, the activity that causes suffering, that causes dukkha. So this practice of learning how to observe the mind, learning how to settle into this innate quality of awareness. It's already present. In different ways we can talk about mindfulness. We might talk about developing mindfulness, cultivating awareness. But there is that aspect of cultivation. But I think we first have to recognize that this awareness, there is awareness as an inherent state, as an inherent quality of the mind. This has a different effect to recognize inherent awareness, to come into presence from a state of inherent awareness, rather than I have to cultivate, I have to be more mindful, I have to watch my breath very carefully to get more mindful. You know, just notice how we start with our cultivation, what different effects they have. When one can recognize awareness is already present, one just has to awaken to it, recognize it, tune into it, dwell there, connect. Then we come into natural presence. We feel the breath coming and going naturally. And thus the breath as an object of meditation can become a support as we learn to abide in presence. Yeah. So this is something I think it's important for us to check out as we're moving into retreat practice in general, but also every time we go to sit meditation or walk meditation. Check out, you know, that quality of mind that you're bringing to that moment. Is there a sense of I must still this mind? Or, oh, I'm so hopeless, I can't keep this mind still. Or can there be this sense of just returning the mind to its natural state of presence, recognizing, coming into presence, and from that point, allow cultivation. From that point, recognize breath. From that presence, inherent presence, recognize the movement of walking, or recognize the mind states that are arising, or the thoughts, if their thoughts are moving through. For myself, I find this approach, whenever, because I can, in my own practice, I can see both of these experiences occurring. You know, I can also end up in places where I'm trying to force my mindfulness, whether in sitting or walking, against the disturbance of the mind, trying to still it. And it can take a little while to wake up to, or remember, actually, how about just tuning in to that awareness that is already present. It's a very subtle shift, but it makes a huge difference in your practice. Yeah? So there's an analogy that Ajahn Chah gave around this idea of the still forest pool. He said, we really, in meditation, in mind cultivation, what we want to do is to be able to observe all the weird and wonderful creatures that come to that pool to drink water or to, you know, search for food. Yeah? This is like an analogy for all the things that are going on in our minds, the different mind states, thoughts, emotions, feelings, sensations, memories that come and go. There are all sorts of different kinds of creatures. Yeah? So our job is to sit quietly by that still forest pool and to observe, to get to know these creatures as they come and go, to get to know their habits, to get to understand them from just quietly observing. But if we're too keen, you know, we might jump up and try to grab some of those animals or push them here or send them away or get disturbed by them. And then we lose the opportunity to really understand how they behave, how they come and go. And yet this is what we can get caught up in practice sometimes when we're struggling with that which is appearing, thinking of it as me and mine, and I've got to control this environment, this inner environment. And that's akin to, you know, having this notion that I want to develop wisdom and stillness, but jumping up and disturbing all these animals so that you never actually get to observe them in their habitual modes. So learning how to sit still within the mind, to allow it to calm and to be willing just to observe and to remember that again and again, that this is a way of cultivation, and to trust that we've got our commitment in terms of our precepts, in terms of outer behavior of body, speech, and to trust that, you know, that is a container for us, that is something we're committed to harmlessness on that level. So having that outer container, we can learn to relax a little more on the inside and watch these weird and wonderful creatures come and go. The mind states, the thoughts, the different moods, what grabs the mind's attention, what stirs up desire or anger or confusion, fear. So these analogies can be helpful for us, these metaphors can be helpful for us when we find ourselves in practice and trying to find that place of, it's really establishing right view, in a sense, this kind of talking now, in terms of what sets us off in the right direction with practice. Of course, we will find ourselves disturbing this mind again and again, but that is also the learning, how to move through and come out of those spaces. So another, we're talking about containers, if you like, useful containers, useful conventions that we create to give containment or container for the practice. So we have the sitting, the postures, the standing, the walking, they're a kind of container for the practice. We have the precepts, as I just mentioned, a container for our practice in terms of sila. We have the retreat space, which is something that we've created, a certain boundaries, a container for our practice. And in the same way, we could perhaps look at the paradigm of the Four Noble Truths of a kind of as a container for our view, a certain skillful boundary or paradigm or container for reflection. So just as we have this analogy of the still forest pool, allowing the wind to settle, or at least observing when the pool is rippled by the wind, as we know from here, it's annoying, but it's not perpetual. It stills. There's times when it stills. In fact, there's many months when it stills, and there's other months when it rages, you know. So this comes and goes, trusting in that observing. But just like with the paradigm of the Four Noble Truths, as another kind of container for our view, to recognize we can reflect when dukkha is present, the first noble truth. This is already helping to shape our view if we can recognize that dukkha has arisen, dukkha is present. And dukkha simply, as we experience it from day to day, unpleasant feelings, unpleasant sensations, a dukkha on that level, not getting what we want is dukkha, getting what we don't want is dukkha, association with the disliked is dukkha, like that old painful memory that might keep reappearing. Yeah, I don't like it. It's dukkha when it's there, you know. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Another way you can look at that, we can see that on the level of relationship, but what about on the level of when we have, you know, a lovely peaceful meditation and then our peace disappears? There's a moment of dukkha, separation from the loved. You know, I want to hang on to that peace. Can we recognize the dukkha in that moment? So this is a frame, a mental framework, paradigm, to keep our wisdom mind, our reflective mind, working in terms of right view. Now, ultimately, right view is described as knowledge or understanding of these Four Noble Truths. Yeah? So when those Four Noble Truths are fully comprehended, fully understood, that is the fully awakened state. So it's not that we're going to get the full comprehension immediately, but we can work the reflective mind around these truths as they're appearing within our own experience. Because that's exactly what this skillful means is about. Not just creating an intellectual framework, but using this framework for recognizing what's happening in our own experience. So dukkha arises. Can we be present with it? Can we recognize it as a moment of dukkha? And when we do, it actually pulls us out of either the aversion or desire that might be otherwise present in relation to that dukkha. If we can see it as the experience of the First Noble Truth, the arising of dukkha, for that moment we're not caught in the struggle with it. And you can feel the difference, you can experience the difference. And this is very important, to experience that difference. Because you've come out of it, you've come out of identification with that particular experience of dukkha when you can see it in that frame. And you have to come to experience that, to know what it feels like, that perspective, that right view. This is dukkha. This is the truth of existence, the truth of reality I'm witnessing. It's no longer a personal failure or a personal problem. It's just, oh, look at that. That's what the Buddha said. That's dukkha. Just that much. And if one can maintain that perspective, one might be surprised that in that moment dukkha ceases because of that maintenance of that right view. And if one's presence, one's remained present, one can know that Third Noble Truth, the cessation of dukkha, right in one's own experience. So we don't want to think about it too much. We want to, yes, we have to do some contemplation about how to understand this framework and how to apply it. But in the moment when we are applying it, it's really about direct apprehension, direct comprehension, direct relationship with the experience of dukkha. And coming to understand as we observe, as we're this metaphorical person sitting quietly on the edge of a pond wanting to get to know all these creatures coming and going. It's a metaphor for the wisdom mind. it's that wisdom mind that is primed when we recognize the coming and going of things. These creatures don't always stay at the pond. They come and go at different times. Yeah. Getting to know that, priming the wisdom mind with the fact that everything comes and goes. The memory that is a painful memory of a previous experience, is it present the whole time? No, it comes and goes. You know, the craving for something that's not present, something that one longs for, whether it's a physical something, an emotional something, or an ideological something, is that craving, that desire, always present? Or can you recognize that it arises? And once it's arisen, does it stay? Or does it disappear? We really have to investigate the coming and going of all the different experiences of this body-mind. Not so much analytically, but being willing to experience, being willing to know, establishing presence strong enough that the knowing is natural. As that person sits with open eyes, keen interest on the edge of the pool, the knowing is natural. We see the creatures coming and going. We start to recognize their habits. The learning is natural. The intelligence is already inherent. And the Buddha's teaching is just priming our intelligence, saying, notice how they come and go. Notice their different characteristics. Notice the ones that tend to bring more calm states. Notice the ones that tend to bring more agitated states. But just notice. This is similar to the territory in the Satipatthana Sutta on the foundations of mindfulness. There's not a lot of instruction in there to get in there and sort these things out, but so much of the refrain through the Satipatthana Sutta, establishing mindfulness of body, of feelings, of mind states and mind objects, it's all about just knowing them as they are, as they come, when they're present, when they're no longer present, when they arise, when they cease. Noticing the factors that are present which cause them to arise, the factors that allow them to cease or disappear. So we have to trust this knowing mind, this inherent wisdom and this inherent intelligence, this inherent awareness, which is really the essence of the Buddha mind, that which is awake, that which knows. That which knows is that which comes to see clearly. Yeah. So the cultivation is within this space, within this quality of mind. And to remember that it's always there as a refuge is very powerful, because much of our despair, or I should speak for myself, can be when you have a sense that, oh, you've lost it, you know? How can I get back on track? But it's just a matter of remembering. Awareness hasn't gone anywhere. This native knowing, natural knowing, is already here. It's just recognize, remember, reconnect. That's all that is needed. And so if practice is is needed, often just these, you know, recognize, remember, reconnect, recollect. And from there, the cultivation develops with exactly what's present, with whatever's present. Not with what should be present or what shouldn't be present, but just with what is. And these Four Noble Truths can indeed be seen right here and now with exactly what is arising and ceasing. In one of the Buddha's teachings, he said that if we see just one of these Four Noble Truths clearly, we actually see them all. So they might appear to be, in one sense, they're quite discreetly different aspects of reality. But if we really comprehend one of them in the direct knowing, in the direct seeing, the other three are known and seen. This is a powerful thing to contemplate and quite hard to understand just at the intellectual level, but when you experience that, you will understand what that's pointing to. So that means the path, the Eightfold Path, appears and functions within this moment as well, can be in this moment of seeing and comprehending the arising and ceasing of dukkha. So where does that leave us? That means the path, the Eightfold Path, is right here within this Buddha mind, this inherent awareness itself, with the seed of wisdom. So the only place to practice is here and now. And although that's always the truth of the matter, whether we're in retreat or out of retreat, whether we're somewhere we like or somewhere we don't like, it's always the truth of the matter. But being in retreat and being in a place and a situation where we find ourselves wanting to be, then it's a really wonderful opportunity to cultivate this path in this moment, with this very mind, with just what is. So we have all the supports in place for our practice, the kindness and generosity of the lay people and who support this monastery and supporting all of us to be in this special time, the kindness, generosity of the lay team who are here to help support the monastics to have a deeper time of retreat as well. So all of these beautiful conditions coming together, so may it be a beneficial and fruitful time for us all. So I'll leave it there. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.